Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Transportation Committee to order. The time is 1:31 p.m. We are in Butrovich, room 205. And today is Tuesday, March 31st, 2026. Members present are Senator Keel, Senator Rauscher, Senator Tobin, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Welcome everyone to Senate Transportation. Please turn off or silence your cell phones and join me in recognizing our recording secretary, Heather Ramseth, and our LAO moderator, Susan Quigley. Our agenda for today is Senate Bill 244, travel insurance, as well as a presentation from the Port of Seward and its potential roll-on, roll-off cargo capabilities. First, we will take up Senate Bill 244, sponsored by the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. It's the first hearing of this bill. To present the bill, we have staff to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, Conrad Jackson. Mr. Jackson, could you please join us and begin your presentation of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. The bill before members today, Senate Bill 244, is a real cleanup of the travel insurance statutes. As we all know, Alaska is really unlike any other state. We're always traveling. We're always on a plane or a long distance drive to go down south to the lower 48. And when something goes wrong with one of our trips, usually it's pretty serious. That's why we need travel insurance that actually works. Right now, our travel insurance statutes just aren't nearly as good for consumers and regulators as they should be. They're confusing and inconsistent. Mr. Chairman, right now, our statutes for travel insurance are covered on one page and a half. The bill before you is 15 to 16 pages. It provides clarity to not only the traveling public, but to regulators, to travel insurance industry. It's been reviewed and is, I guess, endorsed by other consumer industry, consumer groups. It brings fairness and really puts those consumers at the head of the line. Senate Bill 244 is a clear national standard, so Alaskans know exactly what they're buying. There's no surprises or games. It levels the playing field for businesses. The good businesses are in a position of winning. The bad actors, not so much. The regulators have that clear authority to hold folks accountable. 41 other states in the United States have already adopted similar language. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill helps to protect your constituents. We have two invited testifiers online, Mr. Duke DeHaas and Karen Alvarado. We also have Director Heather Carpenter from the Division of Insurance in the room for questions. And that's it, short and sweet, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jackson. Are there any questions from committee members? Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and possibly not for you, Mr. Jackson, but if somebody could answer this in the course of their invited testimony or perhaps afterwards, would this particular legislation have any effect on that little toggle you often click or do not click when you're purchasing your plane ticket on Alaska Airlines that says this will protect your ticket or this will offer you some confidence that if there is a travel delay or if perhaps they've had to cancel the flight that you will receive benefits at the end? I'm just curious if this has any impact on that particular provision, and I'm happy to wait to hear from our invited testifiers if they have the answer.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, I think that Director Carpenter would be the best to answer that. I can tell you from personal experience, I have purchased the travel insurance and unfortunately due to a death in the family, took advantage of the coverage. It did work. I can't say the same for everyone who's purchased insurance from other providers, but in my personal case, it was great. It functioned exactly as intended. So,
thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. We'll go to our first invited testifier. First up, we have Mr. Duke DeHaas. Mr. DeHaas, please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Duke DeHaas. I am Vice President, Deputy General Counsel for Allianz Travel Insurance, subsidiary of Allianz. I'm located here in Richmond, Virginia. It was great to get out there and see some of you. I guess it's been almost 2 weeks now. I really appreciate the opportunity to present on travel insurance legislation. Thank you for the excellent explanation by Conrad, and I appreciate the opportunity to go through some slides here. Somebody just joined, so I'm not able to see you all as well as I'd like, but hopefully you can see me, and I'll ask Conrad to help me here with the slides, because I'm not exactly sure what's up on your screens. But so going to the first slide, and I'll just the reason for the slides is really just to present what's hopefully a little bit more understandable explanation than just reading words on the page. And I will also address through the chair Senator Tobin's question, and hopefully in a way that's satisfactory to her at the end, since that is our product that appears in the Alaska Airlines booking path. So to start, and if somebody interrupts me because we're not on the same page, please don't hesitate to do that. But looking at the slide that says, what is it? A modern framework for travel insurance. Basically, what we have in this legislation, it looks longer than it is. Some of it is because certain sections have to be repeated in their entirety. If you change an aspect of them, there's several pages of definitions. We are building on Alaska's existing limited licensing statute. It's basically fleshing that out and adding some consumer protections. It's not getting rid of anything that's there. And then the rest of the legislation deals with additional consumer protections, permitted and prohibited sales practices, and then accountability. So at every travel insurance transaction, there is an insurance company, a producer, which is often a limited lines travel insurance producer, and what's known as a travel retailer, which could be an airline, cruise line, or travel agency through which travel insurance is offered. And the law lays out in greater detail the consumer protections and accountability to the division, but also to consumers for each of those entities. And basically, this is something that's a national model. NCOIL and the NAIC developed it. It's been around for a number of years. 42 states have now enacted it. It was 41. Washington became number 42 in the last week. So next slide, if we're able, and it's a quick one, just a bit about why this is a good idea. And you can keep on moving to the next slide where the discussion of free of real protections for travelers are mentioned. And these are just a few of the examples. So one of the things that is being built into this, and it's in the marketplace now, but this will be required of everyone, which is a 15-day free look period. Depends on how you purchase travel insurance. If it's electronic, you get 10 days to review the product. And if you decide you don't want it, you can return it for a full refund. And again, one thing to keep in mind, nobody has to buy travel insurance. And I know there is that box when you're buying your airline tickets, but you, of course, do not have to purchase it. And then also the third item mentioned on the slide, it's the box is not already checked for you. So it's not sold through opt-out, and no one in the market will be able to sell through opt-out if you adopt this legislation. Additionally, there is a number of disclosures that are built into the model, no less than 10 actually, some of which you already have in Alaska law as it relates to limited lines producers and retailers and what's provided to the consumer. But additional ones are built into the model. So next slide, please. What it means for the division, which I think Director Carpenter can add to or hopefully agree with as far as the additional things that are nice that are in the law for the regulator, which is there'll be a streamlined filing process. The product is a property casualty product, and this will make clear that it's filed as inland marine. It's not been an issue in Alaska, but there's been some filing issues around the country, and the model will help streamline the process of getting products approved, which should assist in potentially more competitors coming into Alaska, more product availability, and potentially lower prices for your consumers. Additionally, there's more explicit enforcement authority built into the model for the division. And then finally, something that will assist the industry and the regulators uniform definitions that would be applicable to all travel insurance products. Next slide, please. And then just a few quick items for obviously for that we are seeking this and we are hoping to have this. It's helpful to us with a product that operates not only nationwide, but globally for those of you who travel around the globe. This helps in having the product available consistently across state lines. And this would make this much more available in Alaska. So more distribution channels, increased competition, and as I mentioned, streamlined licensing and understanding where each one is in the process and how they're regulated. So next slide, please. Just the updated map that shows 42 states that have enacted this. So you can look across the country. It's red states, it's blue states. This has not had substantive opposition anywhere. A lot of the life of this statute has been thought about, discussed, debated at the national level. But again, we're happy to answer questions. We think this will work for Alaska consumers and will really help folks there because maybe more than any other state in the country, you all are very familiar with travel in order to get anywhere outside of your state. And sometimes, as I found out, even within your state, I was looking at a map when I was up there in Juneau 2 weeks ago. Next slide, and we're getting close to the end here. The reasons to do this, even though it's not dramatically changing the marketplace, it's not going to disrupt anything or carve anyone out or, you know, create problems for anybody who's operating in the industry. This will allow for more consistent products to be offered as opposed to the current situation where certain things maybe are not in the marketplace there. Additionally, there's consumer protections built into the model that are not there currently. So this will allow your consumers to have consistent protections along with those in the other states. And just finally, this has been tested and is already in place. You are not a trailblazer here. In this case, it's already in place in 42 states. And there have been no reported problems. We're not rolling back provisions anywhere. Certainly, you know, the division director Carpenter can check me on that, but there have not been any problems associated or reported with the model in the states where it's been enacted already. So finally, getting to the end, this is not reinvention or creation. It's really just modernization. This is a proven model that works, and we'd like very much to bring this to Alaska so that your consumers can benefit from it, as well as those companies who are operating in the marketplace. I whipped through it quickly. I'm happy to slow down and answer questions. One thing, circling back through the chair to Senator Tobin's question, I try to be cognizant we are not perfect, and we, you know, not every situation is covered, and it's not always a great experience. But we feel like we do protect our consumers, we do our best, and as far as how this will change things with the offer box and the Alaska Airlines site, it doesn't dramatically change it. There may be additional, there's going to be additional protections maybe that are built in, additional explicit authority for the division as far as regulating this. But if you're hoping the box will go away and you won't have to see it, that's probably not going to happen. I just want to be completely transparent. That'll still be an opportunity for you to purchase travel insurance when you're purchasing your travel, which of course is how lots of consumers like to purchase it now. I hope I answered your question. If I didn't, please don't hesitate to ask. And thank you for the opportunity again, and very much appreciate your spending some time on this.
Thank you very much, Mr. DeHaas. Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Bjorkman. And actually, I had probably a different motivation when it came to asking the question. I think often I hear folks say, I don't know how politics impact me or how policy affects my life. And here's a great example. It's something that we interact with pretty frequently, is this little toggle. And there's a lot of dynamics to it, and we want to ensure that Alaskans are protected when it does pop up on their screen. So I appreciate your presentation and for helping us bring this into an applied example that we can share with the public of how this does impact their everyday life.
Through the chair, thank you very much.
Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, through the chair. I probably have never had an incident, nor have I bought travel insurance in the last 8 years. So all I'm asking is to understand what it does for me or you or anyone, and what have we fixed That's just basically the question.
Mr. DeHaas.
Through the chair. So excellent question. And Senator Rosher, I certainly hope that you'll consider us for purchase in the future. I have to admit, I'm not supposed to do this to my own company, but if I'm traveling domestically, I don't check the box. It's often viewed as more valuable, perhaps with international travel, or, you know, where you have emergency medical type situation. The example I like to mention is the person who had a stroke in Italy and had to be medevaced home and had a special place carved out on the plane so they could make it. It's a happy ending. They survived. It was a $70,000 claim. They paid $70 for the policy. So it was a great value proposition for them. Your question's well taken. I'm getting around to answering it. As far as why is it needed? What does it fix? I guess what I would say is your market is not broken. The regulator in Alaska is not a bad one. And maybe I wouldn't say that about all states, and maybe I'd say it a little bit differently. But what this does is it provides a consistent experience for your consumers, and there will be more product availability, and certain things that can't be offered now will be offered. And I'll give just one example. If your child goes to the University of Montana and they are on a sports team, and that team purchases a travel insurance policy on a group basis, which is something that this model or this legislation will allow in Alaska, then that school buys the policy as a group policy, and it covers all of those athletes who won't have to purchase their own. But if you're in Alaska currently, the school cannot buy that policy because that eligible group is not available. Therefore, you'd have to purchase your own policy for someone in Alaska at that university. So this provides, the market's not broken, but this will provide additional avenues to purchase the product. It'll probably provide additional competition, and it should levelize prices because this will make things more consistent for everyone. Hopefully that answers your question.
Senator Rauscher.
Through the chair. Okay. So I'm going to rephrase my question because apparently I'm anyway, if I buy car insurance and I wreck my car, and there's 3 or 12 different levels of what would be they would cover, whether it would be the car, whether it would be me, or whether it would be the passengers or the other car or the house I hit or whatever, I'm buying insurance that takes care of all that. So I stated earlier, I've never bought travel insurance. What am I buying insurance for? What does it do? Because I've never bought it, and I want to know what it covers to know what we're talking about, because I believe I'm at a loss here on what it would do for me.
Through the chair, I apologize. I didn't understand the question. Sorry for the long-winded answer. I think the easiest thing is to look at the definitions for travel insurance, but the example I provided is one example, but only one, of the emergency medical coverage. So in many cases, your health insurance or perhaps Medicare, depending on what it is, will not cover you if you travel overseas. This is a gap filler for that. So it provides for if you break your leg in a foreign country and you have to have your leg, cast up, or you're in the hospital for a couple days, this provides emergency medical coverage. A second one is trip cancellation. So in many cases, somebody will have a loved one who gets sick or can't go on the trip with them. They have to cancel. That's a covered reason under the policy. So you may have paid $5,000 for a cruise and paid $50 for the travel insurance, usually 5 to 8% of the total trip costs, whatever that works out to, maybe a couple $100. You would get your entire cruise reimbursed that you had purchased because you had the travel insurance coverage. Another one is trip interruption. I'll just give an example. This actually is out there in Alaska. We have a product in Alaska that if your trip gets delayed and you're stuck sitting in an airport somewhere, which has happened to a lot of us, I think, we actually have a benefit in the market that you immediately get, because you purchase the coverage, you immediately get $100 or $200 sent to your bank account without you even having to file a claim, because you purchased our coverage, and we have something called Smart Benefits that's in the marketplace there. So those are a couple examples. We also cover things like lost baggage. So hopefully that gets more directly to your question.
through the chair. Yes, that does. Thank you. And I'm looking through this Crum and Foster literature, and I see that everybody's paying a different amount, but they're getting stuff taken care of. And the variation is from $796 for this plan cost all the way down to $139. So I'm trying to understand how that works.
Through the chair, and I'll definitely let Karen speak to her own company's pricing. But typically, Senator, the price is based on a percentage of the trip. So if you go on maybe one day I aspire to be able to do this, but there are people who take round the world cruises where the cost of the cruise is six figures, and 5% of a six figure cruise is going to be, you know, $5,000 plus just for the travel insurance coverage. If you have a $500 airline ticket, 5% of that is going to be, whatever that works out to, $25. So it typically varies based on the cost of the trip. That's what those, by the way, the racing forms do have to be filed with the division and are scrutinized in that fashion.
Well, I think I know a lot more than I knew before, so I thank you very much.
Thank you.
You bet.
We'll go next to our next invited testifier, Ms. Karen Alvarado. Ms. Alvarado, welcome to Senate Transportation. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Karen Alvarado, Vice President of Regulatory Affairs for Crum & Foster, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Fairfax Holdings. My organization has been writing travel insurance for many years and is fully licensed in all states, including Alaska. So we are therefore very familiar with the unique intricacies of these products in the marketplace. I am also co-chair of the Law and Reg Committee for the U.S. Travel Association, along with Duke Tahas, who just testified. I would like to thank the sponsors and the members for bringing this bill before the committee today and for allowing interested parties the opportunity to provide testimony in support of the bill. We are in full support of the bill, which we believe is important for travel consumers, state insurance regulators, and the entire industry. Travel insurance, as you know, plays a critical role in protecting consumers from unforeseen events that can disrupt travel plans, such as medical emergencies, as Duke was just describing, trip cancellations, lost luggage, or any number of natural disasters. And as travel has become more accessible and global, we also know that the risks associated with travel have also increased. Travel insurance provides peace of mind and financial security, ensuring that travelers are not left vulnerable to significant losses. This legislation is essential for safeguarding the interests of Alaska's residents and visitors, given the state's unique geographic and environmental challenges. In Alaska, where travel often involves remote destinations, unpredictable weather, and limited access to immediate medical care, these protections are especially important. Legislation that ensures clear policy language, fair claims handling, and transparent pricing will empower consumers to make informed decisions and therefore travel with confidence. By enacting robust travel laws, Alaska can set a standard for consumer rights and safety, ensuring that travelers are not left vulnerable to any financial hardship due to circumstances beyond their control. This not only benefits individual consumers, but will also support the state's tourism industry by fostering trust and reliability. As Duke said, this crucial legislation builds upon existing regulatory frameworks and further promotes a framework that works for everyone, regulators, consumers, and industry players alike, by promoting a clear and level playing field with minimal negative disruption while promoting uniformity throughout the states. Going forward, this allows for specific requirements applicable to travel insurance, with which all players will have to comply, which very importantly will include any new entrants into this quickly growing market. The language before you today has been thoroughly vetted to ensure the legislation creates an efficient, effective regulatory framework for travel insurance that benefits everyone involved in the market. The bill contains model language from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, which is also identical to model acts authored by the National Council of Insurance Legislators. As Duke has indicated, as of last week, we are really happy to report that 42 states have enacted the Model Act so far, and we're very hopeful that Alaska will be number 43. In addition, several states are also contemplating enacting similar legislation in their states during this 2026 session. The bill standardizes definitions and contains many robust consumer protections, including with respect to sales practices, an important free look period for refunds, and other important consumer disclosures. We want to make sure that Alaskans are getting prompt, knowledgeable, and effective service when they need it most, which is often in stressful or emergency situations when they're far from home. As an industry leader, we support efforts to strengthen consumer confidence in travel insurance. We believe that clear regulation benefits consumers and reputable insurers by fostering a fair, competitive marketplace. Our company and companies like Duke's already adhere to the best practices outlined in this legislation, and we're committed to working with regulators and lawmakers to ensure effective implementation. So in closing, I would urge the committee to support this bill. The legislation will help protect travelers, promote transparency, and uphold the integrity of the travel insurance industry. Please let me know if there are any questions or if I can provide any additional information. And thank you so much for the opportunity to share this with you.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Alvarado. Are there any questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing no questions at this time, thank you both again for joining us today.
Thank you.
I think members have a couple of questions for the Division of Insurance Director, Mrs. Heather Carpenter. Heather, if you could please join us at the table, welcome back to Senate Transportation. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, thanks for joining us today. Always good to have you in front of us. Generally speaking, looks like a good bill. Couple of things, maybe one from the back of the bill first. In the sales practices section, I think it's on page 11, it says it's an unfair practice under Alaska insurance law to sell a policy that could never result in payment of a claim. Never is a very high standard. Is never result the standard that we should have for unfair practices, or something like could not reasonably result, could not foreseeably result? I think back on, I once had a corporate safety trainer provide a training, and he said, if your company vehicle is hit by a meteorite, I'm going to want to know why you weren't watching the news for news of the meteor shower and looking up. Never?
For the record, Heather Carpenter, Director of the Division of Insurance, through the chair, Senator Keel, I don't feel like it would be a question from you if you weren't that precise, so I appreciate that. I will say that this language was heavily vetted as a national model by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners and, again, by NCOIL. So folks, long before I was at the Division of Insurance, were debating those terms. I actually believe Duke DeHaas could give some history there of how they landed on never. I am comfortable with that, but if there is, you know, alternative language you want us to consider, I think we'd certainly be open to that. I will say one of the complaints when I've heard people talk about travel insurance is they feel like they buy it and there's no chance it'll ever pay out. And we want to ensure that when Alaskans are buying this product, they have comfort in knowing exactly what's going to be covered, when it can pay out, and that, you know, they're going to have all those rules in advance. So when they are stuck somewhere or have something happen, they can get paid on that benefit that they've paid the premiums for.
Mr. Chairman, would it be all right to turn to Mr. DeHaas and get a little help with that?
Mr. DeHaas.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, great question. And I guess what I would say is the history of this, and I won't get into too much of it because I don't think it'll be interesting to anyone but me, but what this originally said was in the model, it has illusory travel insurance. And then it has this language that says offering or selling. So it's almost like a definition for illusory travel insurance. So to the question, for some of these other practices that might be viewed as unfair or mishandling a claim or, you know, otherwise doing something that's afoul of the insurance laws, those things are still going to be regulated and watched over by the division for consumer complaints and those types of things. This is really just, it's not to the exclusion of all else. It's really just defining what is considered to be illusory travel insurance. There's a lot more history behind it, but maybe I'll stop there unless there's follow-up.
Senator Teal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be interested maybe in some examples of what we're trying to get at here, and that might help me understand whether the language in the bill is what we need or whether it needs adjustment. If I could ask a different question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Teal.
Director, the Section 2 deals with our premium tax, and your fiscal note says we do collect premium tax, so this looks like sort of it starts with belt and suspenders language, just to make real clear. Can you talk to us about the provisions dealing with premium tax allocation among states where there's the potential for, I can't remember the exact wording in the bill, but the potential to need to split that out? How's that work, and are we changing it from what we do now? Two questions.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, Director of the Division of Insurance. Through the Chair, Senator Keel, this is really just codifying what is happening now. So we are collecting insurance on travel. Like most of our insurance premium tax, it's 2.7%. This lays out, especially with some of the new items that are in here, like travel assistance services that are not insurance, we're not going to collect tax on that. That's not insurance. We shouldn't be taxing that. So by and large, we're not changing how we're collecting taxes. It's really just codifying and updating it for the updated language, which is also why our fiscal note is a zero fiscal note.
And then one last, if I may, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the indulgence, Mr. Chairman. One of the things exempted from premium tax is cancellation fee waivers. And I'm a little confused about what that is and why it's not insurance, because as I look through the bill, what you pay for a cancellation fee waiver isn't a premium, and most of the provisions of the bill don't apply to it, but a travel insurance plan can include it, and it must be described in the filing with the director. So what are we talking about with cancellation fee waivers, and why is it sort of insurance but not for purposes of premium or tax?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I'm looking at the definition on page 14. So that's on lines 2 through 7. And it is, you know, laid out as not insurance. So it means a contractual agreement between a supplier of travel services and its customer to waive some or all of the non-refundable cancellation fee provisions of the supplier's underlying travel contract with or without regard to the reason for the cancellation or form of a reimbursement. I can't speak to why it was decided in the model. Again, that was before I was at the Division of Insurance. I know we didn't have concern with it, but I think it might be better to hear from our industry representatives why they feel that's not insurance.
Mr. DeHaas.
Through the chair, thanks for the question. A lot of history here too. Really good question. Haven't necessarily seen someone delve this far into it in too many places. I guess the easiest way to explain it is if you think about like back in the day, airlines offered refundable airline tickets, which has gone away for the most part. The typical situation now is like with a cruise line, where all our product covers is like post-departure benefit. So the cruise line itself will offer you a waiver, it's called, on the front end. So you buy the cruise, and if you leave, you know, if you cancel your cruise within a certain number of days, that's not going to be covered by the travel insurance provider. It's going to be covered by the cruise line. And that's considered almost like a warranty. I'm trying to think of what's an analogous circumstance, but that is viewed as not a non-insurance product because it's offered by the company essentially that owns the stock. They're waiving their own stuff. And in that situation, the travel insurance is going to be post-departure benefits only. It won't be trip cancellation. And because that's not viewed as insurance, premium taxes are not paid on that. But typically what happens is a filing is made with the division or department indicating that that product is being offered in conjunction with travel insurance. And then one last piece on it, as you gathered from the example I just gave, they're often offered by different entities. So the cruise line is offering the waiver and the travel insurance company is offering the post-departure benefits or the emergency medical coverage, that type of thing.
But it's all part of one travel protection plan in the case of the proposed Section 810?
Through the chair, that's correct. The travel protection plan could include one or multiple of those things listed, travel assistance services, travel insurance, or the cancellation fee waiver.
So, Mr. Chairman, I guess I will get with the director later just to sort of understand how an ordinary consumer understands exactly what they're paying for that's insurance and what they're maybe paying for that isn't. I could use a little more help with that piece. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely. Very good. Any further? Senator Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair. So what is travel? I've traveled from my house to here, and I'll be here for months. Is that travel under an insurance policy? Or is travel from my house in Palmer to Fairbanks, can that be insured? I'm just trying to ensure I understand what we can insure, what we can't insure.
Through the chair, Senator Rauscher, you can insure a lot of things. So I think if you want to get one of those trips insured and you contacted one of the travel insurers and said, would you cover this? They would give you a policy that you could see if that covered your needs or not. So it's really, are you buying that in advance? Does it specify where the beginning and end of the trip is, the dates? In this, we do have a date period for how long a trip can be covered. So it's not that it's forever. I think it's about a 6-month time period. So there are some reasonable sideboards, so you can't just, you know, walk around living your life forever with travel insurance. There does need to be a reasonable start and a reasonable end.
Okay, thanks.
Any further questions? Seeing, hearing no further questions, Director Carpenter, thank you for being with us today, as well as Mr. DeHaas and Ms. Alvarado. We appreciate your participation in this hearing. At this time, we are going to set Senate Bill 244 aside for further consideration at a future meeting. Senator Keel, we're happy to work with your office on any changes that you would like to make and facilitate discussions between your office and the Division of Insurance as well. Happy to work on that and make this bill more better. At this time, we will set Senate Bill 244 aside and take a brief at ease while we set up for our next item on our agenda. Brief at ease. We're back on the record now. It is 2:10 p.m. here in Senate Transportation. We are now going to hear a presentation on expanding the Port of Seward's capability for freight using roll-on, roll-off methodology. First, we'll hear from the Alaska Railroad Corporation, the owners of the Seward Freight Dock, Megan Clemens and Christy Terry. Ladies, welcome to Senate Transportation. We're glad you're here. Please state your names and affiliations for the record and begin your presentation.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon to the rest of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. For the record, my name is Megan Clemens, and I'm the External Affairs Director for the Alaska Railroad Corporation.
Thank you. My name is Christy Terry. I work for the Alaska Railroad Corporation as Vice President of Real Estate, and very pleased to be here. Thank you.
And with that, a brief overview of our agenda. We're going to start with just a quick discussion of the Alaska Railroad before we get into a broader look at our master planning for the Port of Seward generally. But the headline of today's presentation really will be focused on our freight dock that is a part of that port and the expansion plans that we have for that facility, and leaving some time for questions at the end of the presentation. So with that, the Alaska Railroad, of course, it's been around for a little over 100 years, was initially built, owned, and operated by the federal government, but in the mid-1980s was purchased by the state of Alaska, remains the owner to this day. So the Alaska Railroad is an independent corporation owned by the state. We were set up by the legislature to operate as a self-sustaining entity. So we support ourselves through our business activities, through passenger freight and real estate. I mean, we're set up to be responsible for our own financial and legal obligations. But why does the state own a railroad? We have a mission to drive economic development across the state. And again, it's those business activities where we seek to provide value to the communities that we serve and Alaskans generally. So by providing low-cost freight transportation solutions, by providing opportunities to move passengers across the state to different destinations, as well as real estate development opportunities, we're looking to help support economic development across the state of Alaska. And for a quick flyover of some of the assets and activities that we have to help drive that mission, you can see that while we have about 500 miles of mainline track, that mileage number gets close to 700 when you include terminals, sidings, every mile of track that we have. You can see our rail car numbers there, certainly a much larger freight car fleet. But our passenger business is very important. We do operate year-round passenger service across the state. Of course, the focus of today's discussion is primarily going to be our port facilities. So although we are a railroad, we are a multimodal organization. So we do own ports in both Seward and Whittier. And of course, we don't own the Port of Alaska in Anchorage, but we do have tracks that serve that facility and work closely to help move freight from the Port of Alaska across the state. We've got terminals in Anchorage and Fairbanks supporting those large population centers, as well as Seward and Whittier supplying support to those ports. And then, of course, significant land reserves that help provide a important, stable revenue source to help support our operations. And again, additional economic development opportunities that come along with that real estate as well. On an annual basis, we average moving about 500,000 passengers. And last year, we have just under 4 million tons of freight across a variety of different categories. And so you can see kind of the overview there of our tracks go as far north as Fairbanks for passenger service, out to Eielson in North Pole for freight service, and then down to Seward and Whittier for port facilities on the south end of our system. And with that, I'm going to cede the floor to Christy Terry to speak a little bit more about the Port of Seward specifically.
Yeah, thank you, everyone. I'm going to take this next set of slides just to provide an overview of the current operations at the port. So here you see an overview of the Port of Seward that the Alaska Railroad Corporation owns and operates, encompassing over 320 acres of tidelands and uplands. This includes three docks, extensive operational lands featuring a robust rail yard, and properties leased and permitted to various companies that provide essential marine services for both our passenger and cargo operations. So starting at the top of the slide, you'll see where it says barge basin. This area is utilized year-round for dry docking barges and vessels for maintenance, where vendors use a system of those large black marine roller bags that you might have seen and equipment to pull the vessels onto the uplands. Next to the right is the dock that we're focusing on today, the freight dock. So that includes domestic and international cargo vessels with fuel, containerized and breakbulk freight, such as pipe and frac sand, sand. We see military vessels, including Coast Guard and Navy, as well as research vessels. And also, these vessels utilize this dock to load stores, fuel, undergo repairs, cruise changes, and activities. And then moving down clockwise, you'll see the passenger dock. And you all are well aware of the replacement project we have, and I'll just do a quick update on that later. And then what we're calling here the energy dock, that's the former coal dock. And we call this the energy dock or the mooring dock, currently used for longer-term dockage and repair options, allowing for vessels to overwinter in Alaska as opposed to traveling out of state. You can see also indicated is our rail yard. There is used by a wide range of permit holders and tenants for storage and lay down of goods prior to loading for vessel shipment to or from the freight dock or transport by truck or train from Seward. So just off the picture towards the bottom of the slide is our train depot for our scheduled train service route, the Coastal Classic. Some of you might have had an opportunity to ride that, and additional lands that we utilize for leasing in the harbor area. So with this slide, I just want to really set the foundation for all the projects that we're doing in Seward. So beginning in 2015 and finalized in 2017, the Alaska Railroad completed a master planning process called Railport Seward, funded by a generous Tiger grant from the U.S. Department of Transportation and MURAD. The MURAD administrative grant was in the amount of $2.5 million, with the Alaska Railroad providing the $500,000 required local match. So over 100 stakeholder meetings were held as we developed that plan, including deliverables that included a passenger traffic study, considering the railroad passenger facility and activities at the port, a freight traffic study, which considered the railroad freight activities at the Seward Marine Terminal, including activities to and from ship and barge, to and from train and heavy vehicle truck movements, and also around the site and then to and from the site. And then finally, a transportation connectivity study, which considered the intermodal connections that occur and the various connections within the site again, and then significant transportation facilities in Seward, South Central Alaska, and statewide. All of these studies ultimately reviewed existing connection, analyzed those gaps, and proposed improvements with passenger and freight movements, which developed the critical master planning recommendations seen here. So that included passenger dock and terminal replacement, a freight dock expansion, upland development, transportation corridor improvements, and continued real estate permit leasing. So not today's focus, but I feel like we would be remiss if we didn't just give you a quick update on this project. And this is a key initiative that came out of that master plan that I just talked about, the Seward passenger dock. So 137 new passenger dock and terminal facility replacing the old and aging infrastructure. This was further confirmed again by the master planning process, funded through the railroad with revenue bonds secured by a 30-year peer use agreement with the Royal Caribbean Group that guaranteed 140,000 guests annually to operate as an open dock. So this double berth pier with floating dock barges will be able to accommodate a wide range of vessels, including down from Quantum class cruise ships to side-loading marine highway vessels, and this flexibility really ensuring that the dock will be functional for year to come. Now, in addition to a dock, there is over 41,000 square foot of enclosed space with a new terminal, and this terminal is Silver LEED certified, and it will be the largest building for the community events in Seward, with an additional 27,000 square foot covered outdoor space and covered walkways for passengers and staff. And this facility, again, will be available for the community in the off season. Now, another augment to this project is a $50 million shore power project funded by the EPA grant of $45 million with a $5 million developer grant. Now, outside of the tourism season, this battery power system will also provide more resilience to the community of Seward's power grid. So, construction commenced on these projects in 2025, and we are on track to welcome cruise ships in May of 2026.
Senator Tobin has a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you. having worked at the Anchorage Museum, I know what LEED means, but if you could unpack what silver LEED means for the public.
Thank you, Senator, through the chair. It's very exciting in that it what it does is it just ensures that the highest level of supports within the building. It looks at the vegetation around the building to be supportive and just ensures, this project is very environmentally conscious with the EPA Shore Power Grant project. And so it's a number of rigorous requirements to ensure that the building it helps with the resiliency of environmental change, make sure that it is, the systems are energy efficient, the heat is efficient, and just all the things that you want to see in a brand new building. Thank you.
Follow up? Very well.
Well, great. Now on to the star of the show. The Seward Freight Dock that you see here is a 620-foot dock, currently serves barges, international container ships, break bulk, fishing and research and military vessels, and the dock handles approximately 100,000 tons of freight per year, primarily inbound commodities, including containerized freight, mining inputs such as frac sand, equipment, building materials such as forest projects, cement, and glass. So the dock also handles approximately 30 million gallons of fuel per year that is transferred via pipeline between a local petroleum company, inbound and outbound to marine vessels. So the railroad has seen rebound in traffic beginning in 2020 to accommodate shipments of frac sand, pipe, and drilling mud unloaded from vessels and shipped by rail to Fairbanks to in support of the oil and gas development projects at the North Slope. Shipments of these commodities are expected to continue growing. Currently, with the cruise ship dock replacement, our strong freight operations at the freight dock will continue without interruption, with clear delineation lines in place with the passenger dock train tracks. So I want to talk about what you see pictured here on this slide. At the bottom corner, you can see a SeaTac barge with Spinard Builder Supply Materials. When the Turnagain Arm and the Port of Alaska have ice conditions during the winter and spring, these barges utilize the Port of Seward to ensure that these critical building materials can arrive in state for the construction season. Also highlighted above that picture is a heavy cargo ship, highlighting its ability to move bridge pieces, in this case bridge pieces, so heavy cargo, directly from the ship, offloaded onto rail cars. And finally, the other picture you see here on this slide is the Coast Guard Healy. In this picture, they are receiving fuel via barge. So you can see just with these three pictures, the varied cargo operations that currently are conducted at the dock.
Senator Rauscher.
Thank you. To the chair. So page 9, page 6, and page 5. Is this a picture of before the dock extension? Because that's what your literature is kind of pointing to. So that would be before 2017 is what we're looking here, because I think what you said in the previous slide was the extension came in a 2017 master plan, but I'm not sure. I'm trying to get some clarification.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair. So right now I'm just outlining the current dock. So what you see in these pictures are actually the current dock. When I'm done with the current operations, we'll turn it back over and talk about the projects, the grants that we've obtained, and our further development that we're planning at the dock, sir.
Yeah, and just to follow on that for a quick clarification to the chair, Senator Rauscher, so no expansions have been conducted on the freight dock as of yet. So what you're seeing now is the current facility, and then we'll have two phases that we'll brief you on here shortly.
Okay, thank you for the clarification.
Thank you. I have a question in regard to slide 8. Is there any seasonality or seasonal restrictions on the use of these docks or the use of railroad service that would move freight to and from Seward that would impact this project?
To the chair, there's no seasonality. This is an ice-free deep draft port. I do know that moving freight via train, at times we are very conscious and watch carefully avalanche danger and address those concerns.
Right. But again, to follow on to the chair, there's no seasonal blackout window. So while localized weather events may cause short-term delays, we do serve the freight needs through the Port of Seward year-round with rail service.
Very good. Thank you.
The last slide I'll cover today is the current freight dock and the future expansion plans serves as a vital hub for cargo movement across the state. You can see here it's not only a key transportation link to the South Central, but also a gateway to the interior and coastal communities. Our operations continue to expand, supporting freight services to Western Alaska and enabling communities to receive commercial goods and essential materials for major capital projects. So this facility underpins resource development in the interior and the North Slope by ensuring reliable cargo distribution, including critical items like pipe for LNG construction. Seward in particular acts as a primary gateway into the interior. So I'll turn this back over to Megan for her to describe our planning and process to support the LNG construction, importing port pipe through Seward, and then onward to our planning that we have with our upcoming grants.
Thank you. So this is just a brief note, knowing the, general interest and focus on the Alaska LNG project today. It's something certainly that we at the Alaska Railroad are taking very seriously, and that the Port of Seward would be positioned to play a big part in. And so I want to briefly mention that for the benefit of committee members to be keeping that in mind as we talk about the Port of Seward. So, of course, with the caveat that any of the logistics planning in support of the natural gas line project would be subject to the developer's logistics plans. Our operating concept, informed by discussions with the developer, would anticipate that the Seward freight dock would play a large role in bringing pipe into the state of Alaska to support that construction, and that, in fact, the Seward freight dock would be the primary port of pipe intake, with the Port of Alaska, the Port of Whittier, and Port McKenzie potentially playing supplementary roles in receiving that or other ancillary or support supplies for the project. We can get into more details if of interest, but just wanted to briefly mention today, we're conscious of the project. We're excited to support the project if and when it moves forward. And we're keeping this in mind as we discuss the expansion plans that we'll get into here shortly. And we're conscious of making sure that those plans would not interfere with pipe coming into the Port of Seward if needed. So what we're going to discuss are dock expansions, not dock demolitions. So certainly in a perfect world, we could have all of that expansion done before a large project, but certainly we would manage any expansion plans in such a way as to not disrupt any pipe intake that might be necessary for Alaska LNG.
Very good.
All right. And with that, let's focus on some of the recommendations that came out of that master plan initiative that Christy already discussed that were specific to the freight dock. And without overcomplicating it, the headline conclusions of the master plan was that this dock needs to be longer and it needs to be wider to be able to support the efficiency of our operations here. And that comes really in a number of different angles. Certainly, a longer dock is going to allow larger and more vessels to use this facility. So Orca-class vessels currently are unable to dock in Seward. We can also have limitations currently on the number of barges that are able to use the dock. Those sorts of conflicts can lead to inefficiencies. The width of the dock, as we'll talk about here shortly, also plays a big role in the efficiency, both in timeliness of getting goods on or off a vessel, as well as safety considerations. A larger facility just promotes a lot of benefits. And so the recommendations that we saw come out of the master plan was to extend the length of the dock by roughly 375 feet, so taking from that current just over 600 out to 1,000 feet long, and to widen the facility to 300 feet. You can see that the current dock facility there has sort of a wider little bulb on the left end of the dock, and that was added to accommodate some transportation logistics, but really we'd see the benefit in having that 300-foot width, the full extension of the dock facility. And so that is the goal. The benefits and the purpose of this would be to accommodate the cargo growth that we believe would follow and enable us to, again, drive further efficiencies in moving freight, through Seward and across the state. So this was an initiative that we looked at originally back in the 2019 timeframe with an estimated $25 million project cost to achieve both the lengthening and the widening. And in support of that goal, we applied for a MARAD PIDP grant.
Senator Keel. Oh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The existing rail that runs out the dock there now, who is that Alaska Railroad owned or who owns that?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, yes, that is Alaska Railroad rail.
Can you help me with the label on this slide that says new train rail extension by others? Looks like you need another 400-foot of rail. Who else is going to build that for you and why?
Through the chair, to Senator Kyle, I believe this is a slide from the grant application. So we were not funding the rail extension through the PIDP grant application, and I believe that that's why that label's on there. So I think in future presentations we should probably take it off because it's now confusing.
Senator Keel.
So just to make sure I'm clear, the plan is for the Alaska Railroad to own the rail right to the water's edge of the dock. Thank you.
Absolutely.
All right, thank you. All right, moving forward with the dock expansion plans, in 2020, the railroad had applied for and was awarded a just under $20 million MARAD PIDP grant. That's an 80-20 program, and the Alaska Railroad funded a $5.5 million match to fulfill that requirement. However, I know we all look forward to the day when we stop referencing the pandemic as causing delays. Unfortunately, we're not quite there yet. And the pandemic, unfortunately, did affect this project in kind of two significant unfortunate ways. One was delaying the grant execution. So it was important for MARAD staff to be able to travel to Alaska for some of their required diligence in moving forward with the grant. They were unable to do that during the pandemic, which caused significant delays in actually being able to move forward with the project. And then also, we all know we saw significant construction inflation that followed the pandemic. And the result of the delay and the inflation was to erode the purchasing power of the grant award. We were able to work with MARAD to rescope the project and extend the project timeline. It's not the full project that we had originally anticipated, but we were still able to achieve the primary project goals of improved efficiency and ability to accommodate a larger, more diverse group of vessels. We're able to achieve this through the lengthening of the dock, but unfortunately, the widening will not be accomplished by this original grant award. And so we have now moved into kind of a two-phase approach on the Seward dock. And so phase one would be the freight dock lengthening. So this will be that $25 million project. We have funding in place, and construction is on schedule to begin later this year with the expectation that this lengthening will be complete in 2027. So again, we will realize significant benefits from achieving even this partial, first phase of expansion here. So we will be able to accommodate those larger and more diverse vessels. For smaller barges, this is going to allow simultaneous berthing. It's going to increase the terminal capacity and bring efficiency and safety benefits. Certainly still a worthwhile project, but we are still focused on wanting to realize the full recommendations of the master plan recommendations. And that will bring us to phase two. Phase two would be widening the dock. So this would be achieving a uniform 300 feet width along the full 1,000-foot length. We do estimate this to be an $8.5 million project, and we currently have a pending application in for a USDOT build grant. This is a 100% program, so no match requirement, and we've expressed the key benefits that we see as following on from being able to complete this expansion of the Seward Freight Dock. So again, reduced congestion, increased efficiency, all the benefits that we see in having more space for loading, unloading, lay down space, safety, all of those things. I will say the one key benefit that we realize with the widening of the dock that cannot be achieved by the lengthening alone is to significantly enhance the supply chain resiliency of the state by allowing the Seward Freight Dock to serve as a much more robust contingency port for the Port of Alaska. And I think this diagram is helpful in informing that benefit in particular here. So you can see on this diagram an Oracle class vessel represented at the bottom of the picture there. Now, for a vessel using a roll-on, roll-off system, you can see those ramps are represented in the vertical green lines there. And in order to have a safe angle coming down from the ship, you need some length to be able to extend those ramps out over onto a dock facility, and then further enough runway, if you will, once you get a vehicle down that ramp to be able to safely execute a turn and be able to maintain safe and efficient loading and unloading coming into the port. That's not something that we can accommodate with a 200-foot wide dock. It's something that we really need to get to that 300-foot width on, and that's one of the key benefits that we see. Again, not necessarily, when you're contingency planning for emergency circumstances, the hope is to not have to use this functionality, but knowing how critical the Port of Alaska is for the state and so many goods coming in that communities across South Central, Interior, the rest of the state depend on, having this contingency to be able to allow the Port of Seward to serve as that backup, allowing for efficient unloading with all three ramps, having the rail connectivity there, as well as the relatively close proximity to Anchorage by road, really see as a benefit to the state's emergency planning. And that concludes our presentation today. I know we have a couple of other speakers as part of the presentation, but happy to take any questions that committee members might have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Clemens and Ms. Terry. We appreciate you being here with us today. Are there any questions from committee members? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you talk to us just a little bit about berth maintenance? What is the frequency with which you dredge that berth now, and what would be the frequency in future?
Through the chair to Senator Kyle, we really do not have to have a scheduled dredging. What really helps, and sorry, I'm trying to get to a picture for you to see. You can see that they're off the freight dock, right, where that freight dock designation square is. There is a sediment groin there, and that protects the berth from the Resurrection River that comes out there. There is some minimal dredging that we have to do, but it's really the last time we dredged was over 10 years ago. That wasn't due to some man-made shoaling with the tug or something.
Thanks. Very good. Any further questions? Well, thank you very much. I think I understood then. So you have funding in place for phase one. You have a grant application out for phase two, and you expect that grant award to be decided when?
Thank you to the chair. They said we will be notified by June 28th of this year.
Very well. And would a letter from this committee or the legislature help in securing that grant?
To the chair, we would absolutely love that and would supplement our application with that letter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellente. Well, thank you. We're going to take a brief at ease while we set up for our next presenter. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. It's 2:40 now in Senate Transportation. Next up, we have Mr. Corey Nichols from Tote Maritime. Mr. Nichols, welcome to Senate Transportation. Would you please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Corey Nichols. I'm Vice President of Tote Maritime Alaska. I'm also the General Manager, so I oversee the entire Alaska operations. A little bit about me, I joined Tote in December of 25, so about 4 months in. Previously, I spent 15 years at Walmart, 7 of those years in Alaska. From 21 through 25, before joining Tote, I ran the Walmart supply chain for all 9 Alaska stores. To give you a little overview of Tote, we've served the market since 1975, bringing goods, equipment, vehicles, and doing military moves throughout the state. We have a fast, efficient, reliable service twice weekly between Tacoma and Anchorage. We have 2 vessels. They're sister vessels, so they're identical. One's called North Star. One is the Midnight Sun. These were built specifically for the Alaskan trade. Ice strength and hulls, 4 engines. We also run off primarily off of LNG, and we have industry leading 8 hours loading, unloading. Most importantly, as it pertains to Seward, we have row-row operations, which essentially means that we don't need cranes to operate. We use hustlers to unload the ship. As we look through contingency planning, we essentially are vulnerable to seismic activity at the POA. The port pilings are over 50% degraded. And so there's this risk because right now over 2,000 containers and trailers pass through the Port of Anchorage every week, and 95% of the state's food does come through the Port of Anchorage. And so Seward naturally is the ideal spot for our Orca class vessels from a contingency planning standpoint. It's a natural deep water port. Once it's built out, it'll have sufficient space. Especially once it goes from 200 feet to 300 feet, that will allow us to do a 3-ramp operation so that we can unload the vessel. There's robust land and rail infrastructure that will get that freight to the major population centers. And so that's overview there. I'm happy to take any questions regarding Tote's contingency planning.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nichols. Are there any questions from committee members? Mr. Nichols, thanks again for joining us. I have a couple of questions. As we think about the ability to use and take delivery of things at the Port of Seward, what types of things could the state of Alaska do or our economy encourage in order to have regular service from Tote into Seward and not just have Seward be a contingency plan for your company?
Thank you for the question, Chair. Essentially, we only have 2 ships. And once they arrive either in Tacoma or Anchorage, there's a very quick turnaround. And so the ships are never idle. And so with us only having 2 vessels, we could not do both Seward and the Port of Anchorage, and our terminal is at the Port of Anchorage. That's where our staff, our customer service. So at this time, we would not be able to service multiple ports just due to only having 2 vessels.
Understood. Thank you. We clearly see the value, though, of having a very workable, low-cost alternative that does not require very significant upgrades to get cargo from a ship to a rail, and we appreciate that here. So thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Nichols? Seeing and hearing none, Corey, thanks so much again for being here. We appreciate your participation and partnership from Tote and other social companies in doing business here with Alaska.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. We'll roll right into our last presenter for the day. Mr. Bruce Agnew. Bruce Agnew hails from the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, also known as PENWR, and he has brought a most excellent presentation here for Senate Transportation. Bruce, welcome to Senate Transportation. We're glad you're here. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Agnew. I'm the director of the Transportation Accelerator at the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, or PNWR as you referred to it. I'm quite delighted to follow Corey at Tote and Megan and Christy from Alaska Railroad. And I'll try not to repeat their points about the importance of widening phase two of this Seward freight dock project. PNWR has actually been aware of the need to widen this dock for several years. And I think Matt Morrison, our former director, came up with one of Tote's folks, I think it was Seth Storsett out of Tacoma, to talk about this. I may have been before your committee. Well, we're back, and the need for this is as important as ever. And I'm delighted that Alaska Railroad applied for the Build Grant program. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. Both Megan and Christy have been part of our overall work plan for some time, and Megan spoke in front of our Portland Rail Summit, and it's an impressive railroad. I think it's the coolest railroad in America, so you all should be very proud of what they do. We are members of the Alaska Supply Chain Lifeline Committee, and we use the word lifeline because this really is dealing with life and death situations. This committee is chaired by Soshi Castaneda, who's the regional administrator of the USDOT Maritime Administration, or MARAD. You heard Alaska Railroad talk about MARAD. They're a very important partner. Also on this committee is TOAD, Alaska Railroad, State DOT, and other members. We have focused in the last year on how to identify $10 million to get this phase two funded. And we are very pleased that, as I said, Alaska Railroad was put in for a Build federal grant. Now, Soshi could not be here today, but she asked me to submit for the record research material that MARAD is comprised over the last several years, indicating that if the Port of Alaska was disrupted, there are basically a week to 14 days of food and fuel supplies for Central Alaska. And the idea that for $10 million, we can get redundancy in the system, and we have partners like Tote and others, in our mind makes this a no-brainer. We will submit that recommendation or that report to you later this week. In addition, Soshi set up an appointment that I have April 24th in Washington, D.C. with Captain Stephen Carmel. Captain Carmel is the new director of MARAD, comes from a maritime background, and we are going to talk to him about the importance of federal investment in Alaska port capacity. I don't have an ability to move my slides. Could somebody move the slide to slide two, which is, says about PNWR? Is that possible?
We're there.
Okay, thank you. Okay, who are we? Well, the Pacific Northwest Economic Region is a public-private binational partnership that was formed back in 1991. We comprise the states of Alaska, Idaho, Montana, Oregon, Washington, and in Western Canada, Alberta, British Columbia, Northwest Territories, Saskatchewan, and Yukon. So we have several neighbors to Alaska up in the Northwest. We are governed by state legislators like you all. And our delegation, our Alaska delegation, is listed on the PowerPoint. Senator Keel and Senator Tobin are both members of our executive board. Next slide, legislative outreach, please. Now, we had a chance to visit with the chair and some of you when we did our state capital visits back a couple of months ago, and we talked about supply chains. We talked about Seward. I think this session comes as a follow-up to that conversation with the chair. We talked about critical minerals and U.S.-Canada trade negotiations. Next slide. So a little bit about who we are in terms of the transportation program. Our accelerators received back-to-back funding grants from the Build America Bureau at the U.S. Department of Transportation. So we tend to serve as a field office for the Bureau. And in that way, we serve as a portal for our projects in Alaska to all the USDOT agencies, federal highways, rail, federal transit, maritime, and aviation. Now, we do two things. We provide technical assistance to local jurisdictions on how to navigate the federal transportation program. And then we bundle transportation projects that are part of a trade and travel corridor and that connect port gateways and logistics hubs. So we call this Northwest Seaport to Alaska Arctic area, the Alaska Arctic Maritime Corridor. And Seward is critical, as well as the other ports, in maintaining the viability of that corridor. Now, I won't get into a lot of details about our work plan, supply chains, high performance rail, critical ports and bridges, except to say that what we try to do is stack funding for these projects. Is it local funds, state, federal, tribal funds, and match that with private capital. And then we help navigate the federal transportation and credit programs. Next slide, our work in Alaska. We work primarily through our partner and our subrecipient of our grant, Alaska Municipal League, which helps us vet Alaska projects for federal assistance. We have several of those, including projects at Yakutat and, of course, the Seward project and some projects in Juneau. Now, as a bi-national organization with Canada, we also support investments in the Alaska-Canada-Shacklack Highway, Canadian-U.S. ferry connections at Prince Rupert, and the Yukon Port of Skagway Investment Partnership. Next slide, expediting project delivery. Now, there are two major issues at the federal level that we are working on with your, with members of your congressional delegation. There's a bipartisan legislation in Congress to reform our Byzantine federal permit process. Great credit goes to Alaska Governor Dunleavy in working on a joint effort with the White House and the Federal Permitting Council to speed up federal and state review of the projects. Alaska is the first state in the country to engage the federal government in this memorandum of understanding. And then focused on the Seward project, Congress is considering reauthorization of the massive $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill that kicked off in 2021 and expires this September. Of note, Congressman Begich is on that very important transportation committee that is drafting this bill as we speak. What's important to understand is that federal funding comes through formulas to the state DOT and other recipients. This is automatic distribution. Then there are discretionary grant programs that are nationwide competitive and very competitive. Alaska has done very well with those discretionary grant programs. And we referenced the build grant that Alaska Railroad has applied for. It is very important, we recommend to your committee that you can, that you convey to our congressional delegation the importance of keeping those discretionary grant programs, including the MARAD Port Improvement Development Program, funded and with additional resources. It's particularly important given the fragility of Alaska's transportation system. Now, I referenced MARAD-led committee before. This is next slide, Alaska Supply Chain Lifeline. And our primary focus, which has been on the Port of Seward, but we are broadening that focus to include all the ports in Alaska. And at the bottom of this slide, you'll see the type of vessels that Corey referred to and have been referred to in the earlier in the presentation. The tote vessels, vessels by Linden, AML Linden, which services all of Alaska also, and Matson and their container ships. So we've talked about the roll on, roll off. Next slide, 8. Now, I just mentioned this shipbuilding and maritime prosperity zone. The administration and Congress have launched through executive action and pending bipartisan legislation called the Ships Act, an effort to return America's maritime dominance. And our Build America, our Build Northwest Accelerator is working to organize maritime prosperity zones for public and private investments in ports and shipyards, workforce training, and supply chains that feed them. Now, I mention this because the JAG Marine Shipyard is in Seward and, as you know, Ketchikan. And they could benefit greatly in terms of this new emphasis by the federal government. Next slide, promoting federal and credit programs. Our accelerator promotes these programs, and I want to make note of the loan program called TIFIA. The Port of Anchorage, which we very much support their port modernization project, is in line for a loan under the TIFIA program for $500 million to match other capital investments to accelerate their plan. And we've been supportive of that effort, and we're going to be bringing a delegation, which I'll talk about in a second. Up to Anchorage to see the improvements to the port. Next slide. Expanding port, Alaska port access. Now we, our Alaska Arctic Marine Corridor deals with more than just supply chains. We compare notes with ferry systems, and we also take a look at supporting the emission controls with the cruise ship terminals. And here we see the Port of Seward, an aerial shot of a cruise ship in the port, the JAG Marine Shipyard I referred to a minute ago, and the Alaska Native Corporation Huna Totem Whistler Cruise Ship Alliance, a partnership with the Cruise Lines Association and Alaska Railroad. Next slide. And this is the Ties That Bind tour. And what I want to focus on is when we were in Alaska and we met with you all, it was decided that it would be a good idea if we brought from Northwest Seaport and Puget Sound, our state legislators, members of our the Washington State members of Congress, our port officials and industry up to tour Alaska and see how the operation works. And we're going to cover a lot of territory on this tour. There was a report made by the Seattle Chamber in 2015 called The Ties That Bind that highlighted the connections between both states, and whether it's supply chains or fishing vessel recapitalization, Coast Guard operations, oil tanker traffic to from Valdez to refineries. We want to update that report in 2026, and we're hosting this delegation of from Washington State to Alaska, April 27th to May 1st, followed by an Alaska delegation that we would encourage you to join to Washington State in late September. And we have a list of the activities that we would propose for that reciprocal tour. We will be in Juneau, April 27th, and we're setting up meetings with your committee and the House committee and other legislators to go over and to introduce you all to them and develop personal relationships and talk about the issues that connect, the ties that bind Washington, Alaska. And next slide, final slide. We have a summit every year, and this year we are in Edmonton, Alberta. And we would encourage you to take a look at our website and consider joining us in Alberta. The mountains in Alberta are pretty magnificent, the Rocky Mountain Range. I'm not quite sure they're as beautiful as Alaska, but nevertheless, it's worth a visit. So thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the time you've allotted me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Agnew. Are there any questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, we thank all the presenters for the update and information on the expansion of the Seward Freight Dock and that freight dock's potential of providing very strategic redundancy for the Don Young Port of Alaska, as well as a dock that can support very large amounts of industrial freight and other large items. A picture from the slideshow that the railroad gave was a picture of a bridge girder that is now going to be launched above Juneau Creek on the Cooper Landing Bypass Project. So it's pretty impressive to see those very huge pieces of steel go down the highway, and the videos of them being unloaded were equally impressive. So thank you all for your diligent work on this project. We appreciate the support of Penwer on it, and I hope that the folks coming to visit will have a good visit here, and I know a few of us are looking forward to visiting them as well. So, is there anything else to come before the Senate Transportation Committee today? Hearing and seeing none, the Senate Transportation Committee will meet again next week on Tuesday, and our schedule will come out on Thursday. This concludes our meeting. We are adjourned at 3 p.m.